Act 4. 122. Exterior. The town store. Night. We are looking up Main Street toward the center of town. A headlight appears, and we hear the wasp whine of an approaching snowmobile. It's Ursula, with Joanna hanging on for dear life. 123. Interior. The doorway of the supply shed. Night. Cat.
I'm a little teapot, short and stout. Here is my handle. Here is my spout.
Lucien Fournier stands in the doorway. Behind him are Upton Bell, Johnny Harriman, old George Kirby, and Sonny Brodigan. All of the men wear similar expressions of shocked horror. 124. Interior. Cat in the corner of the supply shed. Night. She's rocking back and forth, fingers in her mouth, blood-splattered face blank. Cat.
You can pick me up and pour me out. I'm a little teapot, short and stout.
125. Interior. Resume. The man in the doorway.
Lucien,
with an effort. Come on. Help me get her inside. 126. Interior. The constable's office, with Mike and the others. Kirk.
That fit he threw. What was that about?
Mike shakes his head. Doesn't know. Turns to Robbie. Mike.
Did he have a cane when you saw him?
Robbie.
You bet. It had a big silver wolf's head on top. It was bloody. I had an idea that was what he used to...
Sound. The snowmobile. Light flashes across the barred windows high up in the cell. Ursula is driving down the alley to the back. Mike returns his attention to Linoge. As always, he addresses Linoge with the calm of a police officer, although we can tell this is getting harder and harder to maintain. Mike.
Where's your cane, sir? Where is it now?
No response.
What is it you want?
Linoge still won't say. Jack Carver and Kirk Freeman move toward the back door to see who's coming. Hatch has done an admirable job of handling himself, but he's getting more and more scared all the time, and we can see it. Now he turns to Mike.
Hatch.
We didn't take him out of Martha's, did we? He let himself be taken. Maybe he wanted to be taken.
Robbie.
We could kill him.
Hatch is shocked, wide-eyed. Mike looks less surprised.
Robbie.
Nobody would have to know. Island business is island business. Always has been and always will be. Like whatever Dolores Claiborne did to her husband during the eclipse. Or Peter and his marijuana.
Mike. We'd know.
Robbie.
I'm just saying we could. And maybe we should. Tell me the idea hasn't already crossed your mind, Michael Anderson.
127. Exterior, behind the store. Night. Lucien's snowmobile pulls up beside the half-buried one Jack and Kirk came on. Ursula gets off and helps Joanna off. Above them, the door between the constable's office and the loading dock is open. Jack Carver stands in the light.
Jack.
Who's there?
Ursula.
Ursula Godso and Joanna Stanhope. We have to talk to Mike. Something's happened at the...
She's climbing the steps to the loading dock, and now she sees the wrapped shape that has been put out here where it's cold. Jack and Kirk exchange a dismayed, ah, shit, look. Jack reaches forward, attempting to take her arm and help her in before she gets too good a look.
Jack.
Ursula, I wouldn't look at that if I were you.
She pulls free and sinks to her knees beside the wrapped corpse of her husband. Kirk, back over his shoulder.
Mike, you better come here.
Ursula pays no mind. Peter's green rubber boots are still sticking out, boots she knows well and may have patched herself. She touches one of them and begins crying soundlessly. Joanna stands behind her in the blowing, swirling snow, not knowing what to do. Mike appears in the doorway with Hatch behind him. Mike understands the situation at once and speaks with great gentleness. Mike.
Ursula, I'm sorry.
She takes no notice, only kneels in the snow, holding the patched boot and crying.
Mike then gets his arm around her shoulders and helps her to her seat.
Mike.
Come on in, Earth. Come on in where there's light and it's warm.
He leads her in past Jack and Kirk. Joanna follows with one quick, shying look down at the bundle with the boots sticking out of it. Jack and Kirk follow, and Kirk closes the door behind him against the night and the storm. 128. Exterior. The town hall. Night. Wrapped in thick clouds of blowing snow. 129. Interior. The town hall kitchen with Cat Withers. She sits on a stool, wrapped in a blanket, her eyes staring emptily. Melinda Hatcher leans into the frame. She's got a damp cloth and begins to wipe the spatters of blood from Cat's face. She does this gently and kindly. Sonny Brodigan.
I don't know as you're supposed to do that, Mrs. Hatcher. It's evidence or something.
During this, the camera pulls back, and we see a crowd of looky-loos lined up against the kitchen walls and crowding in through the door, next to Sonny. An aspiring Archie Bunker with a big belly and a sour disposition is his friend Upton Bell. We also may see Lucien Fournier and the others from the shed, plus Jonas Stanhope and young Annie Houston. Melinda looks at Sonny for a moment in wordless contempt, then goes on cleaning the eerily silent Cat's face. Mrs. Kingsbury is at the stove, ladling broth into a coffee mug. Now she crosses with it to where Cat sits. Mrs. Kingsbury.
Katrina, have a little broth. It'll warm you up.
Upton Bell.
Ought to spike it with rat poison, Mrs. Kingsbury. That'd warm her up, all right.
There's a little rumble of agreement, and Sonny laughs out loud at his friend Upton's sophisticated wit. Melinda gives them both a smoking look. Mrs. Kingsbury.
Upton Bell, you shut up your ignorant mouth.
Sonny. Sticking up for his pal.
You're treating her like she saved his damn life instead of sneaking up behind him and bashing his brains out.
Another rumble of agreement. Molly Anderson pushes through the crowd. She looks at Sonny with a withering contempt he can't stand up to, then at Upton, then at the others. Molly.
Get out of here, all of you. This isn't a sideshow.
They shift around a little, but don't really move. Molly. A little more reasonable.
Come on. You've known this girl all your lives. Whatever she did, she deserves a chance to breathe a little.
Jonas Stanhope.
Come on, folks. Let's go. They've got it in hand.
Jonas is some sort of professional man, a lawyer perhaps, and has enough moral weight to get them moving. Sonny and Upton resist the tide for a moment. Jonas Stanhope.
Come on, Sonny. Upton. There's nothing here you can do.
Sonny.
Can take her down to the constables and throw her murdering ass in jail.
Upton Bell. What a great idea.
Yeah.
Jonas Stanhope.
I think they've already got a guy in there. And she doesn't exactly look like she's going to break loose now, does she?
He gestures to the girl who is, pardon the pun, just about catatonic. She has totally ignored the whole thing, may not even know what's happening. Sonny sees what Stanhope means and shuffles out, Upton after him. Molly.
Thank you, Mr. Stanhope.
Mrs. Kingsbury, meanwhile, sets the cup of broth aside, it's a lost cause, and looks at Cat with tired perplexity. Jonas Stanhope. To Molly.
Not a problem.
Where's my mom? Have you seen her? Molly.
I think she's getting ready for bed.
Jonas Stanhope. Good, good. He leans back against the wall, his face and body language saying, Good God, what a day. 130. Interior. The town meeting hall. Night. The benches and the speaker's podium are empty, but a few people in nightwear are going up and down the side aisle. The only woman is old Cora Stanhope, Little Tall's self-appointed queen. She has an overnight bag in one hand. An older gent named Orville Boucher passes her going the other way. He's wearing a bathrobe, slippers, white socks. In one hand, he's got his plastic toothbrush case. Orville.
Say there, Cora. Just like camp, ain't it? Someone ought to put a bed sheet up on the wall and show cartoons.
Cora sniffs, raises her nose slightly into the air, and passes by without a word. Although she cannot help a horrified glance at Orv's white and hairy old man's shins, a generous portion of which are on view above the tops of his socks and below the hem of his robe. 131. Exterior. Rear of the town hall. Night. There's a small brick structure in the foreground, and the engine roar identifies it as the generator shed. All at once, the steady roar falters. The engine coughs. 132. Interior. Resume town meeting hall. Side aisle with Orv and Cora. The lights flicker on and off. We see the two old folks looking up. Any others that may have been using the town hall's bathroom facilities as well. Through intervening shutters of darkness. Orv.
Relax, Cora. It's just the Jenny clearing her throat.
133. Exterior. The generator shed. Night. Settles down to a steady roar again. 134. Interior. Resume meeting hall side aisle with Orv and Cora. Orv.
See? Bright as you could ever want.
He just wants to be friendly, but she acts like he's trying to lure her onto one of those hard New England benches so he can do the dirty boogie with her. She hurries on without a word, nose higher than ever. At the end of the aisle are two doors marked with male and female icons. Cora pushes open the one with the woman on it and goes inside. Or watches her, more bemused than offended. Or strictly to himself.
Cora, friendly as ever, eh?
He heads back to the stairs leading to the area below. 135. Interior. The constable's office. Night. Hatch comes in from the market area, holding a tray carefully in front of him. Loaded on it are 9 styrofoam cups of coffee. He sets it down on Mike's desk, looking nervously at Ursula, who is sitting in Mike's chair with her hood back and her coat unzipped. She still looks stunned. At first, when Mike offers her one of the cups, she doesn't seem to see it. Mike.
Go on, Earth. It'll warm you up.
Ursula.
I don't think I'll ever be warm again.
But she takes 2 of the cups and hands one to Joanna, who is standing behind her. Mike takes another. Robbie hands cups to Jack and Kirk. Hatch gives one to Henry. When all have been passed out, there is 1 cup left. Hatch looks toward Manoge.
Hatch. Oh, what the hell. Want a cup?
No reply from Manoge, who sits in his usual posture, watching. Robbie, with an edge.
Don't they drink coffee on your planet, mister?
Mike, to Joanna.
Tell me again.
Joanna.
I've told you 6 times already.
Mike, this will be the last. Promise. Joanna.
She said, I think it was the cane with the wolf's head that made me do it. I wouldn't touch it if I were you.
Mike, but you didn't see a cane, with or without a wolf's head. Joanna.
No, Mike, what are we going to do?
Mike, wait out the storm. It's all we can do. Ursula.
Molly wants to see you. She told me to tell you that. Said for you to set a guard and get back to her. Said you could have as many men as you need. None of them are doing much tonight anyway.
Mike, that's for sure. Pause. Hatch, step out here with me. Want to talk to you a minute. They start toward the door leading into the store. Mike hesitates and looks back at Ursula. Mike,
you going to be all right?
Ursula.
Yes.
Mike and Hatch go out. Ursula realizes Linoge is looking at her.
Ursula. What are you looking at?
Linoge goes on looking and smiling slightly. Then, Linoge sings.
I'm a little teapot, short and stout.
136. Interior. The town hall ladies' room. Night. Angela Carver, in a soft and pretty nightgown, is at one of the basins brushing her teeth. From one of the closed stalls behind her, we hear the rustle of cloth and the snap of heavy elastic as Cora changes into her own nightwear. Cora. Things from the stall.
Here is my handle. Here is my spout.
Angela looks in that direction, puzzled at first, and then deciding to smile. She gives her teeth a final rinse, picks up her overnight bag, and leaves. As she does, Cora comes out of the stall she changed in, wearing woolly pink all the way down to the tips of her toes, and a nightcap on her head.
Yes,
She puts her own overnight bag on one of the sinks, unzips it, and brings out a tube of cream. Cora.
You can pick me up and pour me out.
137. Interior. The constable's office. The four men and two women watch Linoge in surprise and perplexity. He mimes creaming his face. Linoge sings,
I'm a little teapot, short and stout.
Henry Bright.
He's totally crazy. Got to be.
138. Interior, by the meat counter of the store with Mike and Hatch. It's shadowy and spooky here, with just the fluorescence in the meat counter for illumination. Mike.
I'm going to leave you in charge here for a little while.
Hatch.
Oh, Mike, I wish you wouldn't do that.
Mike. Just for a while. I want to take those women back to the town hall in the four-wheel drive while it'll still move. Make sure Molly's all right, and let her see that I am. Give Ralphie a kiss. Then I'm going to pack every man who looks halfway useful into the truck and come back here. We'll guard him in groups of three or four until the storm's over. In five, what it takes to feel comfortable.
Hatch. I won't feel comfortable until he's in Derry County Jail.
Mike. I know what you mean.
Hatch. Even Mike. Cat wouldn't hurt Billy.
Mike.
I know that, too.
Hatch.
Who's holding who prisoner here? Can you say for sure?
Mike considers this question very, very carefully, then shakes his head.
Hatch. This is a mess.
Mike.
Yeah. You going to be okay with Robbie?
Hatch. I'll have to be. Won't I?
Say hi to Melinda for me, if she's still up. Tell her I'm okay, and give Pippa a little kiss.
Mike. I will.
Hatch. How long do you think you'll be gone?
Mike. 45 minutes. An hour at most. And I'll be back with a truckload of wide bodies.
Meantime, you have Jack, Henry, Robbie, Kirk Freeman.
Hatch. Do you really think any of us will make a difference if that guy starts to rock and roll?
Mike. Do you really think the town hall's any safer, or any place on the island?
Hatch. Considering Cat and Billy, no.
Mike goes back into the constable's office. Hatch follows. 139. Interior. Linoge. Close up. Rubbing invisible cream into his cheeks, humming, I'm a little teapot. 140. Interior. Cora in the town hall bathroom. Rubbing real cream into her cheeks. She's making a night mask for herself and humming, I'm a little teapot. She seems really happy for the first time since being dragged to the town hall by her son and daughter-in-law. Reflected in the mirror is the ladies' room, now empty. All at once, the lights go out as the Jenny stutters again.
Cora,
voice in the dark.
Oh, drat.
The lights come back on. Cora looks relieved and begins creaming her face again. All at once, she stops. Minoja's cane leans against the tiled wall beneath the hand dryer. It wasn't there before, but it is now, reflected in the mirror. There's no blood on it. The silver head gleams enticingly. Cora looks at it, then turns and walks toward it. 141. Interior. Linoge. Close up. Linoge.
Like Dad's.
142. Interior. The constable's office. The men are clustered near Mike's desk. Ursula is seated. Joanna stands beside her. None of those in the office notice Mike and Hatch's return. They are fascinated by Linoge's new dumb show. Joanna.
What's he doing?
Ursula shakes her head. The men are equally puzzled. 143. Interior. The town hall ladies' room with Cora. Cora. Picks up the cane.
Like Dad.
144. Interior. Resume constable's office. Mike and the others watch Linoge. He ignores them, concentrating on his business with Cora. He grips two invisible objects, one in each hand, and turns them. He pushes something else down with his thumb as you would a small plunger. Then he mimes rummaging in something and finding a small object, which he holds up gripped between the thumb and first two fingers of his left hand. 145. Interior. Resume town hall ladies' room with Cora. She has laid Dad's cane across two of the sinks and returned to the one where she was when she saw the cane. She grips the faucet handle in each hand and turns them, starting the water. She pushes the stopper down with her thumb, and the basin begins to fill. While it does, she rummages in her overnight bag and finds a lipstick. She holds it up between the thumb and first two fingers of her left hand. 146. Interior. Resume. Constable's office. Manoj leans back against the wall behind the cot, with the air of a man who has accomplished some difficult and tiring task. He looks at the octet across the room and smiles at them a little. Manoj.
Go on, Mike. Go on. We'll be fine. Give that little guy of yours a big old smackaroo for me. Tell him his pal from the market says hi.
Mike's face knots. He'd like to smash Linoge's face.
Hatch, how do you know so much? What the hell do you want?
Linoge places his forearms on his knees and says nothing.
Mike.
Hatch, why don't a pair of you spend the time until I get back in here with him? The others can hang in the market. You can adjust the mirror out there so you can see and hear.
Hatch, you don't want him to be able to get at all of us at the same time, do you?
Mike, well, it's a plan. He turns to the women before Hatch can reply.
Mike, ladies, let's take a ride back to the town hall.
Ursula hands him a key on a key ring.
Ursula, this goes to Lucien Fournier's snowmobile out back. Thought you might need it.
Mike? Mike hands the key to Hatch, then turns back to her.
Ursula. Peter will be all right out there, won't he?
Mike. Yes, and when this is over, we'll see to him proper. The way we always do. Come on. Ursula gets to her feet and zips up her coat. 147. Interior. Town hall aisle. Night. Joe Robichaud heads down the aisle in her robe, carrying her own overnight bag. Outside, the wind howls. 148. Interior, the ladies' room. Angle on the door. Night. It opens and Jill comes in. For a moment, her face remains calm, the face of a woman embarked on her regular getting-ready-for-bed ritual. Then it fills with horror. She drops her little bag and claps her hands to her mouth to stifle a scream. She stands where she is a moment longer, frozen by whatever it is she sees. Then she wheels and runs. 149. Interior. The sleeping area of the town hall basement. Night. The lights have been turned low. In kid country, all of Molly's daycare pupils are fast asleep. Even the loathsome Don Beals has given up. Probably half the beds meant for the adults are occupied, mostly by older residents. Molly Anderson holds aside one of the makeshift draw curtains, perhaps they're only blankets hung up on clotheslines for this occasion, so that Andy Robichaud can step through. Andy has got Cat in his arms. He carries her toward one of the cots. Following Andy comes Molly and Mrs. Kingsbury. When they reach a cot fairly deep in the room and away from most of the other sleepers, Molly strips back the blanket and top sheet. Andy puts Cat down, and Molly pulls the bedclothes back up over her. They speak low, so as not to disturb the other sleepers. Andy Robichaud.
Woo. She's really out.
Molly gives Mrs. Kingsbury a questioning look.
Mrs. Kingsbury. They're very light sleeping pills. Any lighter, Doc Griffin said, and I could buy them right over the counter. I think it's just shock. Whatever she's done, or whatever's been done to her, she's away from it now. That's probably best.
Mrs. Kingsbury bends, and perhaps surprising herself, puts a kiss on the sleeping girl's cheek.
Mrs. Kingsbury. Sleep well, dear.
Andy.
Do you think someone ought to sit with her, like a guard?
Molly and Mrs. Kingsbury exchange a bewildered glance that sums up just how out of control this has become. Put a guard on inoffensive little Cat Withers. It's nuts.
Molly. She doesn't need guarding, Andy.
Andy.
But...
Molly.
Come on.
She turns to go. Mrs. Kingsbury follows. Andy lingers by the cot for a moment, not so sure. Then he follows. 150. Interior. The basement. Living room area of the town hall. Molly, Andy, and Mrs. Kingsbury come out through the draw curtains. To their left, 40 or 50 people, Many now in their PJs or nightgowns are watching the fuzzy TV. To their right are the stairs. Coming down them are Sandra Beals, Melinda Hatcher, and Jill Robichaud. Sandra is terrified. Melinda is frightened and grim. Jill is on the verge of hysterics, but holding it in. At least until she sees her husband. She throws herself into his arms, crying. Andy.
Jill.
Honey.
What's wrong?
A few of the TV watchers look around to see what's up. Molly looks at Melinda's pale face and knows something else has gone wrong, but this is no time to stir up the others, who are finally settling down for the night. Molly.
Come on. Upstairs.
Whatever it is, we'll talk about it there.
They go up, Andy with his arm around his wife's waist.
151. Exterior, the intersection of Main and Atlantic. Night. The Island Services vehicle comes along, trudging through the snow. It's making progress, but it's also crashing through drifts that are nearly hood high. It won't be making many more trips through this blizzard. 152. Interior. The Island Services vehicle with Mike, Ursula, Joanna. Joanna.
I'm so scared.
Mike.
So am I.
153. Interior. Outside the town hall ladies' room. Standing back from the door, arms around each other, are Andy and Jill Robichaud. Closest to the bathroom are Melinda Hatcher and Molly. Sandra Beals stands between the two pairs. Sandra.
I'm sorry. I can't take any more.
She brushes past Jill and Andy and hurries back down the aisle. 154. Interior. The town office. Night. Sandra, weeping now, hurries into this area, meaning to go downstairs. Before she can, the front door is open and Mike comes in, covered with snow and stamping more snow off his boots. He is followed by Ursula and Joanna. Sandra stops and gives the new arrivals a wild, startled glance. Mike.
Sandra, what is it? What's wrong?
155. Interior. The ladies' room. Angle on the door. It opens slowly, reluctantly. Molly and Melinda come in together, huddled shoulder to shoulder for comfort. Behind them, we see Andy and Jill Robichaud. Molly and Melinda look, faces filling with horror and wonder. Melinda.
Oh, my dear God!
156. Interior. The wash basins, from Molly and Melinda's point of view. Kneeling in front of one of them is Cora Stanhope. The basin is full of water, and Cora's white hair floats on its surface. She has drowned herself in the basin. Written above it in lipstick, on the line of mirrors, is the same old song, "Give me what I want, and I'll go away." Flanking it at either end, Cora has drawn bloody lipstick canes. Of the real cane, the one with the wolf's head, there is no sign. Fade to black. This ends Act 4.